Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
There's no doubt about it, Projectionist. That ghoul fever-infected rat is still on the loose in the vault.
I can assure you, Sage, I left wards in the depths of the vault to bind and trap the infernal beast.
Well, it's not working then, because the Retro's Vault Archive Department arrived to work today and found nearly 1,000 pages of documents had been destroyed. The backup files for those documents were also purged.
That sounds like something of a case of industrial sabotage, dear boy. Perhaps it was that IC robot.
Projectionist, I've told you a couple of times before, IC Robots is a friend to the Retroist and our own podcast. Besides, I doubt he would have painted symbols in the black tongue on every monitor and door of the archives. And the symbols were drawn in, rat leavings.
That might be a good point. I see. Yes, it is as I feared. The infernal beast is on the loose and has evolved from his pupal stage.
Excuse me? Pupal stage? Like a butterfly?
Oh, nothing so benign, Victor. Since it has matured, it will attempt to seek out weapons and...
Weapons? Don't you think it's about time to put the vault on lockdown and find a way to deal with this monster?
No need to get so worked up. It would only be able to use the simplest of weapons. Cutting objects such as knives. Possibly a fire axe. Maybe even a machete. You have to realize it won't be able to begin proper incantations until its next evolution.
Fire axes? Incantations? You don't think that is something to be worried about, Projectionist?
Not in the least. There is, after all, only one. For now.
What did you say?
Oh, look at the control panel. It appears we've begun broadcasting our latest Saturday Frights radio show, dear boy.
We are most assuredly going to have a talk about the safety of the vault and its employees after the show, Projectionist. Friends, thanks for joining us once again. I'm not sure how much of that you might have heard, but we were having something of an infestation issue. Hopefully, it will be taken care of and soon. For all our sakes. On today's show, we're going to be discussing a classic ghost story from 1980, courtesy of none other than John Carpenter. I am, of course, talking about The Fog. Projectionist, I believe you have the trailer threaded up for the listeners to enjoy?
Most certainly.
John Carpenter's The Fog. 100 years ago, between midnight and one, something unknown came out of the fog. Now it has returned. The fog.
Antonio Bay has a curse on it. We're all cursed.
Get inside and lock your doors. Close your windows. There's something in the fog. From the creator of Halloween, the ultimate experience in terror and suspense. Ah! John. John Carpenter's The Fog, starring Adrian Barbeau, Jamie Lee Curtis, John Houseman, Janet Leigh as Kathy Williams, and Hal Holbrook as Father Malone. The Fog. What you can't see won't hurt you. It will kill you. Between midnight and one, it will find you.
The Fog happens to be one of those films I caught at the 62 drive-in of my youth. I can vividly recall sitting next to my father in our car as the movie began.
Confound it all! The plague rat has already learned to use the communication systems!
Hey, Vic, projectionist, I hope you haven't started recording the new show yet.
It's worse than the plague rat. It's intern Rockford J.
Projectionist, mind your manners. For once. Hey, Rockford, we just started the show, actually. Is everything okay?
Yeah, well, maybe. No, it's probably not. The third generator from level 6 is gone.
Surely even you can manage a simple repair on the vault's equipment, intern Rockford J.
Projectionist, I mean it is gone. The power lines connecting it have been gnawed through. I had the decontamination team sent down immediately. Jimbo had to be taken away in a straitjacket after he attempted to read the graffiti left behind.
Oh, man. This is starting to sound like something we need to be worried about, projectionist.
Poppycock, Sage! Jimbo has been twitchy since the vault was invaded and partially destroyed during that siege a couple of years ago. He just needs a long vacation and to stay away from any flashing imagery, as well as portraits or photographs of Aleister Crowley.
Sorry to tell you, projectionist, but Jimbo isn't going to be coming back. Before Mike and Steve could stop him, he began to claw out his...
I'm going to stop you there, Rockford. We need to get back to talking about John Carpenter's The Fog.
Oh, I love that movie. I have two favorite horror movies in my life. One is the Steven Spielberg-produced, Toby Hooper-directed, wink wink, production of Poltergeist from 1982, and the other is John Carpenter's The Fog. Both movies are supernatural horror, both are ghost stories, and that's my sweet spot for horror. That's the kind of horror that I find the scariest. That's the kind of horror that lingers with me when I wake up in the middle of the night and wonder who goes there. What was that scary noise coming from outside the window? I did not see a lot of horror movies theatrically when I was a kid. I'm part of the Star Wars generation, so most of my movie going when I was a kid was of the blockbuster variety, the Star Wars, the Star Trek, the Superman, Indiana Jones, and that kind of thing. The Fog, I'm sure I caught for the first time on cable TV when I was probably 10 or 11 years old in the 1983, 1984, 1985 range. I'm a night owl, and that's about the time that I discovered that I was a night owl and that I liked to stay up after everybody else went to sleep to watch TV and read comic books and play with my action figures and whatever other childish pursuits that somehow linger with me into my old man years. The Fog, I'm sure I caught on a Friday or a Saturday night while I was spending the night with my grandparents and fumbling around with the old floor model TV for something to watch. Man, that's a movie that slaps you in the face and catches your attention right off the bat. That wonderful opening sequence with John Houseman and the kids on the beach, followed immediately by the montage of poltergeist activity around town, really gets your attention. A lot of that reshoots, I understand. Well-chosen reshoots, because it really sets the mood right off the bat before you move into a wonderful slow burn building sort of process as Mr. Carpenter wisely sprinkles some supernatural doings along the way as you are introduced to the citizens of Antonio Bay, all of whom are wonderfully cast. This is an era when there were grown-ups who were actors, and so instead of a lot of underwear models playing all the parts, you got just spectacular character actors like Hal Holbrook and Tom Atkins and Janet Leigh, and then, of course, you know, the two female leads of the picture, Jamie Lee Curtis, praise be her name, and the fantastic, voluptuous, wonderful Adrienne Barbeau, who I still love to this very day. But that's a movie. I watched it that night and frequently glanced over at the big bay doors in my grandparents' living room where I was watching the movie, and wow, made an impression. Absolutely made an impression. And it's a movie that has stuck with me and followed me for the rest of my life. I have owned it in every format: VHS, Laserdisc, had the DVD a few times. I've got at least a couple of Blu-rays for it. And I've even read the novelization, which is something you should check out if you're a fan of the movie. It doesn't deviate too sharply from the film, but it does expand on some things. And you find out what a stomach pounder is, which settled a long-standing question for me and mine from many years. I had the joy of meeting Adrienne Barbeau at the Scarefest Horror and Paranormal Convention in Lexington, Kentucky, 6 or 7 years ago. I have a sort of a bucket list of actors and directors that I would like to press the flesh of, and she was near the top of the list and could not have been more delightful. She talked to me for a good 10 or 15 minutes and asked me about my family, and we talked about John Carpenter, of course, grew up in Kentucky in Bowling Green. She told me all about, you know, that's where they had their wedding. They went back home to Bowling Green, and that she has a wonderful biography that she had with her, and she opened it up and said, here's some wedding photos, and it was just the nicest thing in the world. So if you get a chance to meet Adrienne Barbeau at a convention, don't hesitate. You will absolutely get your $30 worth or whatever it costs to get an autograph or a selfie these days. It was decades, though, before I finally got to see The Fog theatrically. I love to go to revival houses and that kind of thing, summer classic series, and any opportunity to see older movies exhibited theatrically, I jump at. I was blessed to see a lot of great, wonderful, memorable childhood-making films theatrically when I was a kid. I'm always on the lookout for opportunities to see those films again, or to see films from that era that I didn't get to see the first time. And after many years of checking and looking, I finally got to see John Carpenter's The Fog at the beautiful restored Kentucky Theater in Lexington, Kentucky, last October. Studio Canal out of the UK, I believe, last year did a beautiful 4K restoration of John Carpenter's The Fog, which you can get on the Blu-ray from a Region B disc out of the UK. But that restoration was theatrically exhibited last year here and there, and I was delighted to get to see that movie finally on the big screen the weekend before Halloween. I think it was October the 26th at midnight with a very small audience, and you would not expect that a movie that I had seen as many times as I've seen The Fog and could recite half the dialogue from would still be scary. But I have to say, seeing it on a big screen at midnight with a few strangers here and there in the theater, the movie is very scary, very suspenseful, very scary, so much fun. I had a great time, and I would recommend anybody catch it theatrically or otherwise when you get an opportunity. If you're seeing it for the first time or seeing it for the 30th time, it's a movie with a lot of depth, a lot of mystique, and it rewards multiple viewings. Catch it when you can.
That was an awesome memory, Rockford. Thanks for sharing that with us, my friend.
My pleasure, Vic. Projectionist, I'll be down in your wing of the vault after dinner. I'll do my best to clean the sewage pumps tonight.
Very well, Intern Rockford J. Although, I expect you to work double time this evening. No more lollygagging on the job.
Sir, if you would just let me use proper tools and not my hands.
Projectionist?
Enough of that prattle from Intern Rockford J. I believe you were about to tell us of when you first saw John Carpenter's The Fog at the 62 Drive-In. Yes?
How about we go ahead and save that particular story for the beginning of the synopsis, Projectionist? I want to talk a bit first about how the fog came to be.
I assume you mean how the genesis of the idea began after director John Carpenter and the late and great producer Deborah Hill took a trip across the pond for Assault on Precinct 13's press tour.
That would be what I was going to discuss, my friend. Listeners, while in England, Carpenter and Hill,
the two managed a visit to Stonehenge, and while there were encompassed by a deep fog that surrounded the monument, John Carpenter found himself with the seed of an idea of something horrible waiting for them in that fog.
I was going to say something similar, Projectionist, if you'd be so kind as to stop interrupting me.
No, please go on.
In an interview with Consequence of Sound, Carpenter stated, quote, Deborah Hill and I went to Europe. We went to the London Film Festival and just kind of tooled around and looked to see what we could see and what was happening. We went to Stonehenge and it was just mysterious. The fog was rolling in and it was just really moody. Fog is a tremendously cheap effect to do. So I thought, oh, maybe we can do something with this, or make a movie out of this. That's kind of all how it came about. End quote. This was in 1977, by the way, a year after the pretty remarkable Assault on Precinct 13 was released in the United States. Carpenter has also gone on record as saying that the genesis of the fog owes a bit to 1958's The Crawling Eye.
I believe you meant to say the Trollenberg Terror, which was the picture's original title, in which a monster was hidden in a radioactive cloud formation.
That is true. Keep in mind that this was just a mere year before Carpenter would help usher in the slasher genre with 1978's Halloween.
We have broached that subject before, Sage. 1960s Psycho is widely accepted as the beginning of the slasher genre.
I don't know if it's widely accepted, but there is most certainly a strong case for that claim. The fog would end up being part of a two-picture deal with Avco Embassy, with the second film in the contract being 1981's exceptional Escape from New York. Honestly, Carpenter was really firing on all cylinders at this point of his career. After Escape from New York, you had The Thing. In 1983, there was his adaptation of Stephen King's Christine. In the year after, you had Starman. Then, in 1986, there was Big Trouble in Little China, 1987's Prince of Darkness, and 1988's They Live. That is a pretty good run of films, and to be honest, I've always admired Carpenter. As we've mentioned in the podcast episodes for Village of the Dam, They Live, and In the Mouth of Madness, his was a name that meant something to my father and myself. You could count on a quality movie when his name was attached to it. Interestingly enough, John Carpenter was inspired by a real-life event that mirrors what takes place in the fog. That would be a ship that was intentionally wrecked off the coast of Goleta, California, back in the 19th century. This was done in an effort to plunder the contents of the sailing vessel, and it appears to have worked. Although, I don't believe vengeful sailors have ever arrived to punish the descendants of Goleta, California.
Not that you are aware of, Sage.
Agreed, Projectionist. Now, we should probably point out that even with the astounding success of Halloween, The Fog was still given an extremely low budget. I believe it was $1 million. In all, it took 30 days for Carpenter to film The Fog, with principal shooting beginning in April of 1979 and wrapping up in May. The location shooting focusing on various spots in California, like the lighthouse at Reyes Point, and they also shot at Bolinas, as well as Inverness, and even at the Episcopal Church of the Ascension in Sierra Madre, California. The interior shots, such as Father Malone's church, as well as Nick's house, and that of Stevie Wayne's home, were shot at Raleigh Studios in Hollywood, California.
Oh, yes. Wally Studios. That has had a few notable celebrities on its lot over the years, dear listeners.
Really? Like who?
How about Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks Sr.? Have you heard of Hopalong Cassidy, Myrna Loy, and Dana Andrew? What about Betty Davis, James Arness, and Joan Crawford?
I get it, Projectionist. That is certainly a list of talented actors and actresses.
It was founded in 1915 as Famous Players Corporation. It wouldn't be known as Raleigh Studios until 1979. The new owners paid $40 million to greatly expand the studio and facilities over the years. A few of the highlights include Charlie Chaplin, as well as Douglas Fairbanks Sr., using the lot to produce World War I war bond shorts, along with Jack Dempsey. Douglas Fairbanks Sr. used a portion of the studio lot to film 1920s masterpiece, The Mark of Zorro.
That is a fantastic silent film. Well, look up Raleigh Studios after we finish the show, my friend. While it took them a month to shoot the film, Deborah Hill and John Carpenter realized they had a problem on their hands after they put together a rough cut. Namely, that the film just wasn't working. Carpenter was quoted as saying in the 2003 book entitled John Carpenter, Prince of Darkness, quote, "It was terrible. I had a movie that didn't work, and I knew it in my heart," end quote. So, it was decided by Hill and Carpenter that the film was in need of some reshoots, as well as a strong hook to the beginning of the film. Since The Fog is most definitely a ghost story, they hired none other than John Houseman to play the part of Mr. Macon, a crusty old man who entertains the young kids of Antonio Bay with a chilling story of the beach town's past. In addition, they filmed a few more scenes in regards to the attacks on the inhabitants of Antonio Bay. While The Fog isn't exactly gory, heck, it's been said that Carpenter had intended for the film to get a PG rating. They felt that a few more close-ups of hooks and swords penetrating the unsuspecting citizens would ramp up the fear factor. And I honestly think they were right on the money. I've read that when all was said and done with the new shots, that what we see in the finished film, one-third of the movie itself is made up of those additional and improved scenes. That's quite a bit. And in the end, I think it made the film much stronger.
I will concur with your statement, Victor. I must add, however, that when I presented The Fog at the Haunted Drive-In, the audience seemed to be mixed in their appreciation of the picture.
Well, for what it's worth, I know that John Carpenter himself, for the longest time, wasn't happy with the finished product. Although, thankfully, through the years, it seems he has come to appreciate the movie more. It's definitely one of my favorites, but to be fair, I'm a sucker for a good ghost story. Hey, I said as much when we covered 1981's Ghost Story in a previous episode. A movie, I might add, that also featured John Houseman. The critics were pretty mixed on The Fog, with Kevin Thomas of the Los Angeles Times saying in his February 2nd, 1980 review, quote, "An elegant, scary thriller of the supernatural that's far more impressive and satisfying than Halloween," end quote. Now, personally, I think comparing The Fog and Halloween is kind of like comparing apples and oranges. Vincent Canby of the New York Times had a different viewpoint on The Fog, as he wrote in his own review dated February 29, 1980, saying, quote, "Having given us a substantial start on a spooky, old-fashioned ghost story, Mr. Carpenter appears to forget what kind of movie he wants to make. The Fog is neither a rewarding ghost story, nor is it science fiction, though it borrows freely from both genres. There are too many storylines which necessitate so much cross-cutting that no one sequence can ever build to a decent climax. The material is thin," end quote. Ouch. I thought our podcast got bad reviews, Projectionist.
Perhaps this Mr. Vincent Canby was witness to that original cut of the picture.
No, it was released on February 8th of 1980. Actually, its U.S. premiere was held in Santa Cruz on February 1st. And no matter what Carpenter and the critics might have thought about the finished product, the truth is that The Fog delivered at the box office.
Perhaps not as well as Halloween performed, though, dear listeners. After all, that 1978 film was delivered on a budget of $300,000 to $325,000 and earned a truly princely sum of $70 million worldwide.
You should also keep in mind that Carpenter accepted a measly $10,000 paycheck for co-writing, directing, and providing the score for Halloween, with the caveat that he would receive 10% of that entire box office take. So, $7 million isn't too bad of a payday, right? Now, The Fog didn't quite reach those numbers, but like I just mentioned, it did quite well, pulling in $21 million. That is, just domestically. Listeners, I firmly think that one of the reasons that the movie did so well and has continued to find new admirers has a lot to do with the fact that Carpenter once again hired the legendary Dean Kundi as his cinematographer. Kundi and Carpenter have had a long history together, starting with Halloween, but he went on to be the cinematographer for Romancing the Stone, the Back to the Future trilogy, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Jurassic Park, and Apollo 13, to name just a few. Carpenter and Kundi decided to shoot The Fog in anamorphic widescreen to give their movie an extra visual punch. To put it simply, it looks as if the film had a bigger budget, thanks to that aspect ratio. Just before we jump into the synopsis for the movie, if I recall correctly, I brought this up on the already mentioned Ghost Story podcast. In my opinion, there are very few really great movies that involve ghosts. Perhaps I should clarify, there are very few that will give you that enjoyable sensation of reading a good ghost story. Let's take Poltergeist, for example. A wonderful film, to say the least, and most assuredly contains ghosts and the supernatural. But when I think of a movie involving ghosts that I enjoy the most, I think of 1963's The Haunting, or 1972's The Asphyx, 1973's The Legend of Hell House, or another 1980 film, The Changeling. Just recently, there was Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak in 2015.
Mood! I believe what you are responding to in those films is the mood, Victor.
Projectionist? I think you just totally hit the nail on the head, my friend. Because, obviously, the likes of The Shining, or certainly The Sixth Sense, are movies that involve ghosts. It's just the likes of the films I just mentioned stand out for me personally. Okay, I think it's time to dive into the synopsis for The Fog. As always, remember this is a full discussion of the movie. So if you haven't seen it for yourself, and don't want some elements of it to be spoiled, you should pause now, and rejoin us after you've caught the film.
What about when you first caught The Fog? At the 62 drive-in. You said you were going to discuss that memory.
I was just about to. For some reason, when they showed The Fog, they started it just a little too early. It was still twilight, so the beginning of the movie was a little hard to make out. It didn't matter, though, because we had that great narration by John Houseman as Mr. Macon to draw us into the film proper. Like a few of my memories of that drive-in that are so ingrained, just talking about it, I can still almost smell that chili dilly pickle, a staple when I attended the 62 drive-in. It was definitely my favorite treat. I can recall on the driver's side window, my father had placed that old beat-up speaker, and somehow, whether a trick of my memories, I will swear it somehow sounded better than the ability to have it piped through our vehicle's speakers today. As my father and myself focused on making out what was going on the screen, since it was a dark campfire, the narration by Houseman seemed to have us leaning ever closer to the dashboard. It just immediately began to suck us in. As I previously mentioned, this was an addition after viewing the rough cut of the film. So Carpenter and Hill had this supposed beachfront where Mr. Muckin is telling his story to the children of Antonio Bay built on a soundstage at Raleigh Studios. The background, the darkness of the night, is just black sheets, in fact. It really is an incredibly powerful opening, but don't take my word for it. Let Houseman demonstrate the power of his opening himself. I'll ask you to indulge us with this clip, as it's longer than we generally share. It's just too good to not present the whole thing. As a bonus, you get to hear a little of Carpenter's magnificent score.
"11:55, almost midnight. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12. Just to keep us warm. In 5 minutes, it'll be the 21st of April. 100 years ago, on the 21st of April, out in the waters around Spivey Point, a small clipper ship drew toward land. Suddenly, out of the night, the fog rolled in. For a moment, they could see nothing, not a foot ahead of them. And then they saw a light. My God, it was a fire burning on the shore, strong enough to penetrate the swirling mist. They steered a course toward the light, but it was a campfire like this one. The ship crashed against the rocks. The hull sheared in two. The mast snapped like a twig, and the wreckage sank with all the men aboard. Bottom of the sea lay the Elizabeth Dane with her crew, their lungs filled with salt water, their eyes open and staring into the darkness. And above, as suddenly as it had come, the fog lifted, receded back across the ocean, and never came again. But it is told by the fishermen and their fathers and grandfathers that when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea, out in the water by Spivey Point, will rise up and search for the campfire that led them to their dark and icy death. 12 o'clock, the 21st of April.
Now, that is the only time Mr. Mutkin appears in the film, but his tale of Antonio Bay's past is extremely important, as it's the main plot point. Interestingly enough, there are three stories that are shared in the fog that relate to strange happenings at sea. This is the first one, but another one will be told by Father Malone, played by the great Hal Holbrook, and the third coming from the character of Nick Castle, portrayed by the equally great Tom Atkins. And yes, the character was named after Nick Castle, Carpenter's friend, and none other than Michael Myers in 1978's Halloween, aka The Shape.
After that wonderful campfire tale, as the bells ring out the midnight hour, Antonio Bay experiences some rather bizarre circumstances, almost as if it is a warning of the coming of the fog.
Furniture moves on its own. At the nearby gas station, the pump suddenly turns on and starts pumping gas. Its lights flicker. Within the store itself, a janitor is busy mopping the place up, and we can see the glass bottles within the case shaking, as if a minor earthquake was taking place. And, like my co-host mentioned, this is indeed a supernatural warning of the fog, and its inhabitants' arrival. In fact, Carpenter has called this scene of Antonio Bay being woken up to their car alarms going off or their TV switching on as the activity of a poltergeist. It is during this time we are introduced to Father Malone, as well as his assistant at the church, a man named Bennett, who finds out the hard way it's best not to ask the possible alcoholic Father Malone about getting paid. Bennett, by the way, happens to be played by none other than John Carpenter himself. Here's an additional fun fact. Hal Holbrook was not the original choice to play the aging priest. Carpenter had originally wanted the late Sir Christopher Lee for the role, who I've read showed interest in the part, seeing the character as being the father of the community of Antonio Bay. Sadly, the actor's schedule wouldn't permit him accepting the role, so Holbrook stepped in.
And does a magnificent job, if I say so myself.
Oh yeah, projectionist. He's one of the highlights of the film, to be sure, although the fog has no shortage of great performances. After Carpenter makes his exit, a large stone suddenly falls from the wall to reveal, hidden within, the diary of Father Malone's grandfather from 1880. At the same time, we are introduced to Nick Castle as he's driving on the outskirts of Antonio Bay and comes across Elizabeth Solly, who is a hitchhiker and played by none other than Jamie Lee Curtis. The two have a nice and playful chemistry. In fact, the part was written for Curtis, as even though she had the success of Halloween, the only role she was able to secure after that was on an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th century, as well as The Love Boat. So I've read that Carpenter and Deborah Hill, who were quite fond of the young actress, added her a part to the script. As the last bells ring out to signify the midnight hour, the windshield of Nick's truck explodes. While the two aren't harmed, they are nevertheless quite shaken up by the bizarre ordeal. Returning to his home, where we learn that Elizabeth is quite a talented artist. However, as the last minutes of midnight are ticking down, there comes a knocking at Nick's door. An odd visitor that, unbeknownst to Nick, is using an ancient hand gaff hook to knock against the doorframe. Before Nick can greet the visitor, the clock strikes one, and the apparition vanishes as if never there.
Radio host and lighthouse keeper, Stevie Wayne, played by John Carpenter's then-real-life wife, Adrienne Barbeau, is playing a selection of jazz music for those staying up late in Antonio Bay. He notices that there is a fog bank. A most curiously glowing fog bank that is moving against the wind itself towards a vessel called the Seagrass.
Wayne gives a shout-out to the crew of the Seagrass. In reality, it's just a trawler with three guys enjoying getting drunk on board. Soon that fog suddenly appears, and the crew are shocked to see as they go above deck to find the Elizabeth Dane slowly and silently passing by their own vessel. The ancient sailing ship is enshrouded by the fog, but we can make out just enough to see the tattered remains of its sails as it glides by. The three men do not have long to find themselves puzzled, maybe even spooked by the appearance of this ghost ship from Antonio Bay's past, before apparitions appear behind them, cutting them down with swords and hooks before vanishing as quickly as they appeared.
One of those men upon the Seagrass looked awfully familiar, Victor.
I know who you're talking about, projectionist. That would be George Buck Flowers, as Tommy Wallace. Yet again, a character named after a friend and cohort of Carpenter's. Wallace first worked with Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon on 1974's Dark Star. In fact, Dan O'Bannon is also a character name in The Fog, the town's meteorologist played by Halloween alumni Charles Cypher. As the morning arrives, Stevie Wayne's son, Andy, who was one of the children listening raptly at the campfire the previous evening, is down by the beach while his mother is sleeping, and happens to spot a flashing gold object in the waves near the shore. Being a young boy, he immediately goes to investigate, and it appears to be a gold doubloon. The waves wash over it as he reaches for it, and it has changed into a piece of driftwood that has etched into its wood the name Dane.
I will give you one guess as to what that is short for, dear listeners.
Andy still absconds with it and does his best to tell his still-trying-to-sleep mother of how it changed from a gold coin to that piece of driftwood. In Stevie's defense, remember, she works as the nighttime radio personality and the lighthouse attendant. As this is going on, the fact that the Seagrass didn't show back up to port is causing some concern for Nick. This is a small seaside community, after all, with many of the families having helped found the town itself. His friends were on that boat. Elizabeth is tagging along with him, and Nick decides to have a friend with a ship of his own take them out to sea, possibly to find out if the Seagrass had engine trouble or the like. Meanwhile, Kathy Williams, played by the late and great Janet Leigh, who just so happens to be the real-life mother of Jamie Lee Curtis, is driving with her assistant, Sandy Fadell, portrayed by yet another Halloween alumni, Nancy Loomis. Mrs. Williams is in charge of the big 100th anniversary party for Antonio Bay, and she's driving herself and her rather put-upon assistant to go and meet with Father Malone, to make sure he's still on board with giving the benediction after a candlelight procession. You can tell that Mrs. Williams definitely has put everything into making sure the celebration will be memorable, but she also has something far greater on her mind. her husband didn't return home the previous night. He and his two friends, you see, were on the seagrass. Mrs. Williams mentions that their dog began howling at midnight and wouldn't let up until 1 a.m. Sandy reveals she too had something bizarre occur, with her car alarm going off beginning at midnight. When the two women arrive at the church, the only thing they are truly worried about is whether or not Father Malone might be too far in his cups at this time in the afternoon. But it appears that Father Malone has been doing something else. He has stayed up all night reading his grandfather's diary. And it reveals a rather horrible secret for Antonio Bay, to which he reads certain passages to an equally stunned Mrs. Williams and Sandy.
Yes, it would appear that Father Malone's grandfather and five other of the small settlement's members back in 1880 were contacted by a man named Blake. In exchange for gold, Blake would found a community for his people, a leper colony that would settle nearby Antonio Bay. It would seem the town's founders decided to accept this offer as they wanted the gold payment, but not the lepers themselves. Six conspirators made plans to steal the gold from Blake.
From midnight until 1 o'clock, we planned the death of Blake and his comrades. I tell myself that Blake's gold will allow the church to be built and our small settlement to become a township, but it does not soothe the horror that I feel being an accomplice to murder. April 21st, the deed is done. Blake followed our false fire on shore, and his ship broke apart on the rocks off Spivey Point. We were aided by an unearthly fog that rolled in as if heaven sent, although God had no part in our actions tonight. Blake's gold will be recovered tomorrow, but may the Lord forgive us for what we have done. I couldn't read any further.
Your grandfather had a way with words.
Our celebration tonight is a travesty. We're honoring murderers.
As the trio let the truth of their forefathers sink in, well, if we're being honest here, Mrs. Williams and Sandy aren't so horrified that they're going to cancel the 100th year celebration. Nick and Elizabeth have managed to find the seagrass, adrift in the open waters. Upon boarding it, Nick is shocked to see the condition of the vessel. There is seawater everywhere in the engines, including even in an open beer can, as if the ship itself had been submerged. The gauges have all been destroyed, and seaweed is strewn about. And yet, there is no sign of Al Williams or the other two men. Nick, having lived in Antonio Bay his whole life, as well as his family, is totally creeped out by it all, and relates to Elizabeth a story his father told him about finding a derelict vessel, where it looked as if the people on that boat were just plucked off of it. There was still a warm cup of coffee on a table. Elizabeth is more concerned with the eyeless corpse of Dick Baxter, the third member of the crew, falling from out of the hold onto her back. Over at the lighthouse, Stevie Wayne is busy listening to radio promos for her station. As she sets about to get everything set up for her nightly broadcast, she did manage to take Andy's piece of driftwood with her, and has set it upon a shelf of cassette tapes. Unbeknownst to her, at least at first, water begins to well up from the carving of Dane in the wood, leaking out until it causes the tape player she was listening to short out, and an incredibly creepy voice, which I believe was provided by Charles Nicken and is meant to be the voice of Blake himself, replaces the promos. I'm going to let my co-host read this line instead of playing that actual clip.
Something that one lives with, like an albatross around the neck. No, more like a millstone. A plumbing stone, by God.
Well done, projectionist. After that, the piece of driftwood changes again, reading, "Six must die," before bursting into flames. Stevie uses a fire extinguisher to put it out, and when she looks at it again, the driftwood is not only unburnt, but reads Dane once more. As you might imagine, she is seriously freaked out by this and calls home to warn Andy that above all, he is to stay away from the beach and remain in the house. As Stevie's getting her first taste that something very unnatural is going on in Antonio Bay, Nick and Elizabeth have managed to bring the body of Dick Baxter back to the town, so that Dr. Fibes can perform an autopsy on the corpse. And yes, Carpenter did in fact name the town's doctor after Vincent Price's excellent character of Dr. Anton Fibes. The news from the examination is odd. Fibes tells Nick that the body exhibits signs of having been underwater. For days. Obviously, none of that makes sense, and Nick is quick to point that out, with a good doctor, while both the men are standing outside of the morgue. Inside, Elizabeth is startled for the second time by the corpse of Dick Baxter, as it apparently decided to get up on its own and walk towards her after picking up a scalpel, collapsing near the young woman, but not before it carves the number 3 on the floor with that sharp instrument. A quick aside, since this occurs so soon after the events of the lighthouse, I've read in a couple places online that they feel Blake has actually taken possession of Baxter's corpse. I don't know. That might be the case, or it could just be a representation that the power of Blake and his drowned crew are growing more and more powerful as the celebration of Antonio Bay nears. Speaking of which, the celebration is held, and the citizens gather to hear Mrs. Williams and other members of the community express their appreciation of the virtues of their founding fathers, all but two present, unaware of Antonio Bay's dark history. As the 100-year anniversary is being observed, Nick and Elizabeth do what any two sensible people would do who have experienced what they went through earlier in the afternoon. Go to the nearby bar and get a few drinks in them. Nick hears Stevie Wayne's broadcast, asking for sailing vessels to keep an eye out for the seagrass. Nick calls the station to let Stevie know that it was found. And in return, Stevie relates her experiences with that bizarre piece of driftwood. Nick decides to drive out to the lighthouse with Elizabeth and check it out for himself. But it appears, with the celebration underway, the fog and its hidden inhabitants have had enough, and they are now in full revenge mode. Worst of all, Stevie from her lighthouse can see how quickly and unnatural the glowing fog begins to roll into Antonio Bay. Over buildings and down roads, almost everyone is at the celebration, so they aren't listening to her radio reports. Or, in the case of meteorologist Dan O'Bannon, who quite obviously has a thing for Stevie, he doesn't listen to her warnings as the fog encircles the weather station, and a heavy, metallic knock is heard on his door. Not heeding Stevie's pleas to not answer the door, Dan is killed by a member of Blake's crew. The fog next heads toward Wayne's own home, knocking out the power so that Andy and his elderly babysitter, Mrs. Kobritz, are unaware of the danger surrounding the home as the fog cuts off everything from sight. Sure enough, there is a knocking at the Wayne's front door, and at this point, Mrs. Kobritz is getting a little spooked herself, sending Andy to his room to make sure all the windows are shut, which spares the young boy from the grisly sight of the poor woman being yanked out the door and stabbed repeatedly.
However, help is quick to arrive, as Nick Castle and Elizabeth Solly have been listening to the increasingly frantic radio broadcasts by Stevie Wayne, who helpfully gives her home address so that someone might attempt to save her son.
Agreed, and it's a near thing, too. Nick and Elizabeth aren't the only ones listening to the radio, however. Mrs. Williams and Sandy left the celebration after the candlelight procession began, and they happen to hear Stevie's broadcast on their car radio, describing the direction the fog is headed, and seriously, you can hear the apprehension in Adrian Barbeau's voice. In addition, Mrs. Williams and Sandy can see for themselves how oddly the fog is acting, which, by the way, you might realize it's kind of hard to make fog do what you want it to, especially outside of a studio soundstage. So, how the filmmakers accomplished the effect of that deep fog rolling over everything was to build it in miniature within the studio. Not of the town, but of the shape of the town, the buildings and hills, so they perfectly match what had been previously filmed. The miniature shapes of the real environments were draped with black fabric. Then, when they used the fog machines and lighting, they could just superimpose it on the film itself. So, it looks like the fog is chasing Mrs. Williams and Sandy, as well as Nick, Andy, and Elizabeth, up to Father Malone's church. Blake and his crew are tired of messing around, thrusting their fists through the stained glass windows of the church itself in an attempt to get at the survivors, which is probably a bad time to find out that Father Malone has gotten quite drunk. Granted, attacking ghostly mariners have a way to sober you up pretty quickly. And it seems the priest realizes that what Blake and his crew are here for is simply revenge. They seek the deaths of the surviving descendants of the six conspirators who sent them to a watery grave. They already have five and are doing their level best to gather the sixth, when Father Malone discovers, thanks to his grandfather's diary, that there was one other secret. His grandfather stole the gold and had it melted down into a crucifix, hiding it within the walls of the church itself. Stevie Wayne, meanwhile, is having problems of her own. Friends, I get the idea that, much like when the bell struck 1 a.m. and the ghostly sailors vanished, they only have this one night to get their revenge. So Stevie has come under assault herself. Perhaps Blake and his crew don't care who the sixth member is now. Wayne has to climb up to the very top of the lighthouse in an effort to avoid being murdered by the revenge-seeking mariners. Father Malone, with the heavy gold cross in his arms, to the dismay of the other survivors, walks bravely into the nave of his church, which is now shrouded by that sickly-looking light of the fog. And standing with a bandage and leprous hand on the pommel of the sword is Blake and some of his cursed crew. Blake, by the way, is played by none other than makeup and effects maestro Rob Bottine. Malone announces who he is and not only offers up their stolen gold, but himself. However, when Blake touches the gold cross, it begins to glow painfully bright, and it is evident that both the undead captain as well as Father Malone are experiencing a great deal of pain. Then suddenly, Nick appears and yanks the priest back, leaving Blake holding the treasure alone, who is quickly consumed in the white light, and vanishes along with his crew. Just in time, too, as Stevie was about to be murdered by the marauding mariners. The fog dissipates from the town of Antonio Bay, with Stevie Wayne manning the radio, warning everyone that can hear her voice that since this happened once, it might happen again, and that everyone should keep an eye out for the fog in case the supernatural threat isn't over. As Nick and the others leave the church, grateful to be alive, later that evening, Father Malone is quite simply stunned that Blake didn't take him, especially since he was the direct descendant of one of those responsible for the wreck of the Elizabeth Dane.
Unbeknownst to the holy man, dear listeners, a fog has begun to pour forth from under the door. Just as soon as Father Malone turns to see that Blake's crew has returned, he manages to turn around to see Blake with sword raised high before the apparition swings it down and the film cuts to black as we hear the decapitation of Father Malone.
Listeners, with Blake claiming the sixth descendant of the conspirators, the fog is at an end. Friends, thank you as always for putting up with our overly long synopsis. As I mentioned earlier, The Fog has thankfully managed to gain more appreciation through the years. Much like John Carpenter's films The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China, it appears it had to patiently wait to find that appreciative audience. Much like Blake and his crew with the revenge, I suppose. Carpenter's love of H.P. Lovecraft is pretty evident in this film. For one thing, as Stevie Wayne is driving and she's listening to the radio, you hear an announcement mention that the search has extended to include a sweep south of Whiteley Point and Arkham Reef. That wouldn't be the only thing that Carpenter included in The Fog that he was an admirer of. For example, Stevie's radio broadcast of caution at the end of the film was most assuredly a tip of the hat to the ending of 1951 sci-fi horror masterpiece, The Thing from Another World, which was directed by Howard Hawks. A director that Carpenter has admitted he admires greatly. Actually, Adrian Barbeau was very much against smoking, but it's been rumored that Carpenter wanted Stevie to resemble a Howard Hawks type of female character, which is why you see her smoking in the film. I didn't actually mention it in the synopsis, but I would go so far as to say that Barbeau's character is actually the main protagonist of the film, even if she's pretty much locked down at the lighthouse for most of it.
I'm not so sure that I can agree with your statement, Victor. Would you not say that this is an ensemble picture?
Sort of, projectionist. And you're right, but we spend the most time with Stevie, in my opinion. Listeners, please don't get me wrong. Like I've already said, there are great performances by everyone. Tom Atkins brings that likable everyman quality. And while Jamie Lee Curtis was picked to sell the film in the marketing, posters and such, When you get down to it, none of the protagonists would have made it without Stevie's help in that lighthouse. There's something I've always wondered about the end of the movie. This isn't a nitpick, just something I like to think about. What happened to the rest of the citizens of Antonio Bay? The last we saw of them, they were all in a candlelight procession. Did they see this giant and more than a little creepy fog bank coming at them and decide to take cover in a local business?
Perhaps they did hear Stevie Wayne's broadcast to avoid the fog and seek shelter.
I suppose so. I guess that Janet Leigh's character will be told by Nick that he found her husband's boat, too. Here's another fun fact you might not know, projectionist. Adrienne Barbeau based her performance on the late-night radio jockey known as the Nightbird, Allison Steele.
I was indeed aware of that. You think that the haunted drive-in was unable to receive radio broadcasts? Dear listeners, at the beginning of 1968, Allison Steele was given the graveyard shift at WNEW, and she was able to craft her radio personality of the Nightbird.
And we are off the ground in fine style on this Valentine's Day 1977. I'm Allison Steele, the lovebird for tonight here at WNEW-FM in stereo until 2 o'clock. And we're going to send as many Valentines as we can. They're not all such pretty love songs. I mean, they're all pretty songs, but some of them might surprise you just a little bit. They're not the general love song.
Projectionist, let's hear a brief clip of Adrienne Barbeau as Stevie Wayne.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. For the men of the seagrass, 15 miles out tonight, a warm hello, and keep a watch out for that fog bank heading in from the east. Now, in the meantime, relax with me while I play this song from the Coupe de Villes, dedicated just to you.
I think it's pretty evident that Barbeau patterned her speech on that of Allison Steele, my friends. Actually, listeners, there was a fun shout-out to Carpenter's band, the Coupe de Villes, in that clip. The musical trio consisted of Carpenter, Nick Castle, and Tommy Lee Wallace. I believe they've only released one album, and that was entitled Waiting Out the 80s. Although, having said that, they did provide the cover song for Big Trouble in Little China. I've read there was a time that John Carpenter and Deborah Hill played around with the idea of doing an anthology series based upon the locations and characters of the fog. And while that didn't lead anywhere, in 2005, there was a big budget remake, with John Carpenter and Deborah Hill receiving producer credits. It did not do so well at the box office, but it at least made its money back. Of his involvement in the film itself, Carpenter said, quote, "I come in and say hello to everybody, go home," end quote. Projectionist, can you imagine what it must have been like living in Antonio Bay and hearing Stevie's broadcast as the fog descends upon the town?
Attention all Retroist employees who can hear my voice. I don't know what happened to Antonio Bay tonight. Something came out of the fog and tried to destroy us. In one moment, it vanished. But if this has been anything but a nightmare, and if we don't wake up to find ourselves safe in our beds, it could come again. To the ships at sea who can hear my voice, look across the water, into the darkness. Look for the fog.
I told you, Sage, the Retroist is always spying on us.
Or the Retroist was kind enough to go along with that prank, Projectionist. With that, friends, I think we have reached the end of our episode on 1980s The Fog. We truly thank you again for joining us for the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retroist.com. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements through the week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. A huge thank you to Rockford J for sharing his own memories on the fog. You can find him every single day, sharing his own love of retro horror on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too, and the Retroist site. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast and going along with a good prank, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So, when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit the Retroist. In addition, if you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes or Stitcher and Spotify to help spread the word. Now, let's listen to a clip from the subject of our next show.
I am the Shadow Man, and I will never harm the person under whose bed I live.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.